Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Tenable Network Security. Big thanks to them. So in this week's sponsor interview, we will be chatting with Amit Uran, Tenable's new-ish CEO. New-ish. He's just come over. Amit has an interesting background in InfoSec, and he'll be joining us to talk about a few things. Tenable just launched a whole new platform called Tenable.io, which is interesting from a sign of the times perspective, but we'll also get his thoughts on where he sees things going in the industry more generally. This isn't Amit's first CEO post. He was previously the big cheese at NetWitness, then RSA, so he certainly has the experience to weigh in on trends. There's no feature interview in this week's show. Instead, we're going to spend a bit more time with Adam Boileau talking about the week's news. But hey, if you didn't listen already, I published a new podcast last week to the main feed. It's a new series called Soapbox, and the first edition was a 45-minute, pretty in detail chat about DevOps. So if you haven't, I would recommend you check that one out. But anyway, let's get stuck into the news now with Adam Boileau. And dude, we have got a lot of interesting news to get through this week, and it looks like we could see some charges against Hal Martin, the NSA contractor who, you know, crossed the air gap with, as it turns out, 75% of Tailored Access Operations toolset. You know, he walked that across the air gap for reasons. And yeah, it looks like he's off to court real soon.
Yeah, no, they, well, there's a whole bunch more details about what data he actually got out of there. And yeah, as you say, that 75% number is pretty scary. Something like 50 terabytes, which, I mean, obviously that's much less meaningful, but that's a significant, a pretty significant risk for TAO to have so many of their tools leaked. And of course, people are going to ask the questions, as we did when we first covered this, about whether this potential, this was one of the ways that the shadow brokers could have got data out of the NSA. But yeah, we don't know that yet. But yeah, it's really not looking good for this guy. They're going to throw the book at him by the look of it.
Well, you would think if you're a foreign intelligence service, you would want to own up as many home networks of people who you know to have contact with air-gapped sections at NSA as possible, right? And, you know, that means the big question is, would they have known that he had access to that information?
Yeah, well, exactly. And I mean, it would be a very smart move to do so. The question is, can they figure it out? If, for example, I don't know, you had owned the office personnel management and stolen everyone's security clearance documentation, maybe you would know where everybody was and what they were doing.
Yeah, well, that's a very good point that I didn't actually think of. So, yeah, that's a good one. Now, speaking of, attack tools being dumped left, right, and center, I wonder if Hal Martin's been the guy knocking over all the Bitcoin exchanges. I wonder if that's what he did with all that O-Day, right? Cellebrite, we saw their customer portal or whatever got owned some time ago, but now we're seeing a bunch of their iOS cracking modules popping up online. That's interesting.
Yeah, so when they originally said it was just kind of customer data and support stuff and there wasn't any, you know, actual tooling in there. And it sounds like what's happened is that there were like firmware update images for their, you know, forensic collection appliance for getting data from mobile phones. And those have now been kind of unpacked and reversed enough to get some of the tooling out of it. There was some manner of like crypto or copy protection kind of stuff involved that's since been cracked. A bunch of the tools are starting to leak out. Some of them do in fact look like direct rips out of the jailbreaking community, which is
surprise. Holy color me shocked.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, there's no actual surprise, but yeah, much sort of faux wringing of hands is being made of that, which is exactly what we'd expect. I mean, they got a jailbreaker just like everybody else, and why wouldn't you use GeoHot Slime Rain if you had it handy, which clearly they did. But yeah, it's not a good look for them, obviously. How much of this technique is still useful? I mean, especially in the iOS case, I don't really know. But apparently, some of the BlackBerry tooling they've got is actually sort of genuinely interesting rather than just being ripped off jailbreaks and stuff. So yeah, worth looking into if mobiles are your platform of interest.
If that is your scene, as we say. Bad news for Mac using dissidents in Iran. A whole bunch of, activists have switched over to Macs because, the thinking being that they're less likely to be infected with state-sponsored malware. But, of course, you only need a X number of activists to shift over to that platform before your adversary retools, and that seems to be what's happened here.
Yeah, there's some interesting research coming out of Group Security Without Borders, which is kind of a new startup with some, you know, familiar names from this kind of research scene. Claudia Guarneri is certainly one example. Co-authored a paper looking into some Mac malware being deployed by the Iranians. It's not particularly sophisticated from a technical perspective, like it's fake flash updates that you get linked to and then download and run and own your box. But yes, it's being used in the wild against dissidents in Iran. So, you know, that's, as you say, it follows the business needs of the adversary, in this case, you know, presumably the Iranian government, and enough people have moved to make this a real thing.
And of course, this story makes it obvious once again that we need to regulate zero day.
Well, clearly, because flash updates are the most, you know, most serious zero day we'll ever see.
Oh, God. It's just amazing, isn't it? You know, you look at all of the regimes that do the nastiest stuff to people. The stuff Bashar al-Assad was using against Syrians was all like this. It was all stuff like, you know, bad flash updates and, you know, they had the power to block Skype.com and redirect it to some, you know, crappy website where you could download the Syrian government's version and just get owned sideways. So, yeah, it's pretty interesting that we still do get bogged down in that zero-day debate, so-called debate. Now, look, moving on to some other stuff here. And, you know, we all remember Freedom Hosting, which was one of those services where a lot of the Tor Onion sites doing, you know, offering all sorts of nefarious stuff were hosted. Freedom Hosting 2, a successor, has been thoroughly owned, as you would say. Well, quite a lot. They were owned quite a lot. But Joseph Cox over at Motherboard managed to actually have a bit of a chat to the person who claims to be behind it. And it's an interesting read because basically what they're saying is they took over the hosting platform and they weren't going to really do anything with it. And then they noticed that I think the standard storage allotment for hosts on Freedom Host was like 250 meg. And then this person noticed some of them had up to 30 gig content and it was all child exploitation material, which made them realize that it was likely those people were paying for the storage and for the hosting. And they said, well, screw you, guy, and defaced it.
And not only defaced it, actually grabbed the database dump and a whole bunch of the system config information and put them up on the, you know, on the torrent servers for other people to download. And apparently they have a full copy of all the rest of the content, which they are willing to share with someone who will pass it on to law enforcement. But obviously they're not dropping because, as you said, it's full of child exploitation material. But the hacker also said, A, that it was his first significant hack, which, you know, good going, guy. You did well there for your first time. And he also discussed how he went about doing it. And it's you know, a pretty sweet kind of chain of trad Unix hosting, you know, shared hosting hacking through, you know, creating an account, manipulating the file system through creating a symlink through SFTP access, and then escalating your access through, you know, editing of the Apache config that you can get through in your own account to gain access. Anyway, pretty cool little bug chain, you know, standard technique for any shared hosting platform and, you know, interesting to see used in the wild.
Someone who knows their Linux, basically.
Yeah, someone who knows how to hack Linux boxes, yes.
Staying with dark market stuff, and this is absolutely hilarious, but some of the darknet websites are now offering bug bounties, to which I replied when a friend of mine posted this on Facebook, aren't darknet bug bounties just called Bitcoin wallets?
It's a very good point. Yes, you can keep what you can steal, perhaps, and then report it. I don't know, that seems like a good way. But no, the Hansa Underground Marketplace is offering bug bounties up to 10 Bitcoin for bugs in their site that leads to de-anonymization of users or vendors or administrators of the site or access to the underlying site with lower Bitcoin amounts for other bugs in their web app. So, you know, seems like a pretty legit bug bounty. They said they're going to operate it in much the same way as would anyone else, apart from the fact that it's all Bitcoin, all on Tor, and to improve the quality of underground markets.
And I'd imagine it's illegal too, because, you know, at that point you're sort of acting for them to protect them in some way and you're receiving money for it. I can't imagine that that's going to be legal. I mean, obviously, you know, if you know what you're doing with tumblers and stuff, you're not going to get caught, but I would be careful about participating in those sort of bounties, wouldn't you?
It does seem somewhat questionable, yes. And I'm not sure that you necessarily want to help those people, but yeah, you're probably right.
Banks in Poland having kind of a hard time.
Oh, jeez. So apparently a whole bunch of Polish banks, something like 20 commercial banks in Poland had some kind of, you know, malware. Attackers were all up in their business. And it turned out that the, you know, patient zero for this particular thing was their financial regulator. The government financial regulator for Poland had been owned and was being used to distribute malware into bank systems. And top it aloft, make it even better. This particular regulator, it's called the Polish Financial Supervision Authority, was in fact the group that sets the cybersecurity standards for the Polish banking industry. So, face to the palm.
I think it's, it really kicked up with the SWIFT stuff last year. But, given the sheer number of banks these days, and, there's just more and more. And they're everywhere and they're all interconnected and they're all using shared messaging platforms and stuff. And we're starting to see these types of intrusions more and more. And I just, you just sort of wonder where that's going to go. I mean, banks have generally kind of led the way, at least in the private sector, in terms of actually investing properly in security. But stuff like this still happening, it makes you feel a little nervous.
Well, it does. And this is a really good example of someone sitting down and going, okay, what's the overall, ecosystem look like? Where are the hard parts? Where are the weak parts? Let's not attack where they defend well. Let's go attack somewhere else and work our way through the supply chain. It's very, very well done. And I think we will absolutely see this kind of thing, done elsewhere and in other industries.
No word on whether or not the attackers in this case got away with any loot. So we'll just have to keep our eyes peeled for that. Oh, now a story that's been doing the rounds big time over the last few days is these Vizio smart TVs. I mean, this is more of a privacy story than a security story, but these smart TVs were doing per second tracking of what people were watching, sending it back to this company who were then on-selling the data. And look, as someone who works in media, I can tell you that sort of data would be, it's pure gold. The problem, of course, is they were passing on other information like, income, value of the person's house, things like that. And it's just really creepy, right? So I think they've paid $2.2 million. This company got caught doing it. There's been a finding against them. They're paying a $2.2 million fine and they're going to, promise to stop doing it. But it's a matter of time before this is just commonplace, you would think.
Yeah, I'm surprised actually that fine is so low. I mean, you would have thought, given quite how sort of blatant it was, that they would have been fined more. Yeah, but this is clearly going to happen. The more Internet of Things that we have, the more that the vendors will be competing on price, and the more they have to find other ways to monetize it. And clearly, getting this kind of data out of it, whether it's your TV or your fridge or what was it, your sex toys from that talk at DEF CON last year. It's a clear way to monetize this stuff. So, of course, it's going to keep happening.
It is. Now, look, this next story has been the talk of the town the last couple of weeks. I didn't include it last week because, honestly, I'd already read about this in less detail last year. It turned out Donald Trump's campaign was throwing buckets of money at this big data analytics firm to do customized, really customized targeted advertisements to people's Facebook pages based on a profile of their personality. But you look at how much money, I remember reading it and thinking they spent some millions with this firm and then they upped it by a factor of, 5 or 10 or something. And I thought, wow, this stuff must work. And Motherboard is actually carrying a very, very interesting write-up about this. And I guess really what's interesting about this is just by analyzing people's likes on Facebook, it's possible to get a very good idea about what makes that person tick.
Yeah, it's a really scary and fascinating and challenging article, I think. And obviously the technology itself that they're talking about it is challenging to the extent that now it's challenging democracy itself, perhaps. But no, it's a really interesting write-up. And yeah, I was amazed at the level of accuracy that they can get and the being able to tune the data as well as they have and use it very well. And there's some interesting kind of screenshots in the article of some of the tools that they had for campaigners on the ground to kind of know in advance a whole bunch of stuff about households they were going to go and target, as well as, of course, the online advertising, very hyper-targeted advertising. It's really, really fascinating. And obviously the intersection between, this kind of data from sources like Facebook and then the data collected, perhaps surreptitiously in the case of that, Vizio TV story, being able to tie all those things together is just, it's this topic, cyberpunk future, as we have said many times on this show.
And I think, after you read this story, you pretty much want to go have a shower because it is yes, just really, super yes. creepy. But it reminded me that once many years ago, I was on a panel at a conference. No, it wasn't a conference. It was Splendor in the Grass, the music festival. I was on a sort of privacy and information security panel there. And we were talking about privacy and social networking, specifically Facebook. And I remember one of the panelists, who's quite a well-known woman here in Australia named Marieke Hardy, said, well, look, I sort of control what I put out there. It's all in my control. So what's the problem? And I think at that point I said, look, it's not really about what we intend to say. It's about what can be inferred from our interactions with social media networks. And that's not necessarily obvious. And it really isn't, is it? You look at some of the data points here and it's just freaky, right? So you can predict a skin color with 95% accuracy based on an average of 68 Facebook likes. You can pick their sexual orientation to 88%, you know, confidence and affiliation along party lines, you know, intelligence, religious affiliation, alcohol, cigarette and drug use. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's really quite, we are giving away more than we realize, I think.
Yeah, I thought one of the interesting things that I picked out from the article was that they discovered a very strong correlation where they knew people who were already going to vote Republican or vote Trump, that there was a strong correlation between owning an American car and voting Republican. If you had a Japanese car, you were obviously less likely to vote for the Republicans. And that's, you know, you can use the data set that you've gotten from somewhere like Facebook, which is aggregate data about other people, and then learn from that and then reason about people who don't participate or don't share widely or don't like lots of stuff, you know, don't have those kind of inputs to the system. And you can still reason about them. And I, for example, I don't have a Facebook account, which probably puts me in a very small pool and says lots of things about me, you know, by virtue of not participating in that. So it's, you know, it is really not as simple as, well, I don't share as widely as, you know, as some other people do, so therefore I'm fine.
Well, you know, do you use a smart TV, right? I mean, that's the thing. At the moment, these data sources are ones that we contribute to, but in the case of the TV thing, you know, not so much. So that's kind of why I found this interesting, you know, to pair those two stories together, because right now it's Facebook. Who knows what's going to be happening in 10 years from now? Look, staying with This Week in Creepy, we've got a whole creepy center section of the news here. Google's done some research on using machine learning to transfer like 8x8 pixel images into actual, you know, 32x32 image pixels. And it's a little bit unsettling how accurately they can do that.
It really is. I mean, I'm sure everyone who listens to the podcast has seen those ridiculous scenes in, you know, in cop shows on TV where they enhance the
pixelated,
you know, rubbish
license plate,
pixelated,
right?
License, yeah. Plate, or, you know, faces or whatever, and
or
zoom
the
in
sticker
and,
on a car shot from like 200 meters away on a CCTV camera that, you know, looked like it was bought at Best Buy.
Yeah, everyone's, we've all seen that trope, and yeah, Google has actually implemented it, which is particularly scary. They've taken machine learning and kind of taught it how to, you know, synthesize data from very low res images up towards more high res images, kind of probabilistically based on other stuff it's seen. So kind of, you know, their examples are regenerating people's faces from very, very pixelated images and then comparing them against the real thing. And it's A, it's creepy, obviously. B, the potential for misuse is just, I mean, the idea that, you know, in the security camera video footage case, that you could just kind of make up facial data that kind of looks believable and then go with it. It's just not the same as actual data. It's data made up probabilistically. And I think that in a lot of lay people's case, they might not understand that nuance. In fact, in the research field, it's actually called hallucinations. The data, the technical term for that kind of thing produced by a neural network in the way that they are, is actually called hallucinations. But I just don't see, you know, average people on the street really seeing the distinction.
Quite. Moving on, and it's tax season in America. It's tax season in America, which means
I think you mean fraud season.
Yeah, which means the usual smattering of stories from the likes of Brian Krebs and Steve Reagan. You know, I mean, the IRS, we spoke about this last year. You know, they're going to slow down refunds, basically, to try to jam up the attackers. You know, Krebs has got a piece up here about how all of the dark market selling W-2 data are, you know, springing to life, and it's all just like, yeah, it's fraud season.
Yep, it is fraud season, and unfortunately, you know, some of the advice that that some of these articles have, it was a CSO piece, and it's basically saying that when people are being fished to get this kind of data, that we just have to kind of rely on them to, I don't know, does the CEO really send emails like that? Does it sound like the CEO? Like, if that's the defense you're going for, we're so screwed.
Yeah, yeah. Now, look, one interesting thing about the internet growing up is the volume of data that's been left around, just left lying around for 10 years or more, is growing exponentially, which is great news for people who like to find stuff. I'm not sure how old this one is, but a company called Denuvo that make DRM tools for game developers, they just left some stuff lying around and it's been snuffed.
Yeah, apparently they left the log file for their like contact us form on their website, such that you could just retrieve it over the website if you knew what the file name was. And it had, you know, obviously never been rotated. It contained years and years and years of messages of people contacting this company, including game developers, you know, asking about licensing the technology, that kind of thing. Very embarrassing for Denuvo and kind of a bad follow-up, because they had their, you know, kind of flagship game copy protection system quite publicly cracked a couple of weeks ago. So they're having a bad time, and this is a follow-up, and I guess why they were getting a bit more attention from the hackers.
This one only dates back apparently to April 25, 2014. But just as I say, mark my words, the volume of stuff that has been left around and sort of forgotten about, it is increasing exponentially at the moment. Like, it is, there is a lot of stuff lying around there, and just more and more and more and more every day. Oh, Ars Technica has a really nice little op-ed here from Dan Gooden, basically about Microsoft's response. I mean, most listeners would have heard that there was this SMB bug going around that was basically like on the client side. So if you could get someone, trick someone into connecting to an SMB share under non-default settings or whatever, you could blue screen of death them. It got a lot more attention than it probably deserved, because Cert gave it a 10 out of 10, like, impact rating. They later walked it back to 7.8. But, you know, it was given this very severe rating. What was interesting, though, is Microsoft's communication around this bug when journalists were contacting them was, well, you know, you need to be using Windows 10 and Microsoft Edge, which has nothing to do with an SMB bug, right? So they're kind of going back to the bad old days of doing tangential marketing around security bugs. And that's, you know, I know that there's a lot of people at Microsoft who listen to this show. Please stop.
Yeah, it seems like they had handed off their response there to their regular PR firm rather than letting, you know, MSRC or actual engineers field the questions. And, you know, Microsoft have done historically in the last, you know, kind of 10 years or so, a really good job of communicating about security. And MSRC has been a very successful kind of group. And we kind of, you know, from the outside, it does kind of look like security has lost, you know, the kind of real focus it had post, you know, Blaster Slammer era at Microsoft, and it's kind of, you know, stopping being a really important thing and has now gone back to a thing that is just going through the regular corporate processes, which is how you got into the problems you had in the first place.
Well, to be clear, we're just talking about the communication side, right? We cannot actually say that about the security team, but perhaps their communication strategy could use a little improvement.
Well, yeah. And I, you know, this bug in particular, I mean, I think it was what, like a null pointer to reference in the end?
Yeah, it was.
Wasn't really clear at the beginning that it was just that. So you can see how, you know, there was some adjustment as we learned more about the bug and the trigger got more widely kind of looked at and the actual crash was triaged. But yeah,
but use Edge as your response to this? Like, come on, guys.
Yeah, really not a sterling response to what really should have been a very straightforward, like, this is not a you know, straightforward exploitable bug. You know, patch your things at the regular patch cycle. That's, you know, didn't need to have PR people involved.
Yeah. Now, Ars is carrying a fantastic headline on this next piece, but it's not all it's cracked up to be. The headline is radio stations that ignored major vulnerabilities start playing anti-Trump song. That Trump, of course, is by Nipsey Hussle and YG, and I think it's just called Donald Trump.
It is.
Now, that sounds like an amazing story until you realize that it was actually just this like little IoT low-power FM radio transmitter with known vulnerabilities. So we'd be lucky if like 10 people actually heard the song on the jacked stations. But it's still a fun story, right?
It's a great story. Yeah, it's a wonderful headline. But yes, as you say, sadly, a few low-power FM stations, not the widespread ownage that, of course, would have made for a much more entertaining story. But yes, I'm sure you can do better. Whoever did this, I'm sure you can do better and take over TV stations and cable news and the whole lot.
St. Jude Medical still patching their stuff.
Still patching their stuff. Now they're issuing some updates for their another model of their like implanted cardiac, you know, the pacemakery things that we've talked about last year when Muddy Waters found a bunch of bugs and shorted their stock and all that kind of thing. So yeah, they're patching another one. They're kind of walking back some of the harsh language that they were using, claiming all their products are fine as they are now reproducing the bugs and patching them.
And yeah, of course, MedSec sort of quite happy about this. You know, the quotes in here are great. After initially denying any existence of vulnerabilities, St. Jude has changed course and started to reproduce our research inside their own environment. This is exactly what they should do. Now they are starting to release fixes. This is the beginning of what we expect to be a continuous process of fixes released by St. Jude. So I'm not actually sure what the current status of that lawsuit is, because at one point St. Jude was suing MedSec and Muddy Waters. So I wonder if they're just going to sort of, you know, withdraw it quietly and just hope the whole attention dies down. Because I don't know how they were going to go in that lawsuit, you know?
No, I can't imagine it was going to go well. But yeah, I think, you know, I'm sure everyone involved would like that to just quietly go away.
Yeah. We got a new announcement out from GR Security, GRSec.
Yeah, so the GRSec team have been talking for a while about their wrap technique for preventing code reuse exploitation of memory corruption attacks, so ROP, or, you know, return into libc, although this is focused on the kernel, so in the reuse of existing code to kind of exploit memory corruption bugs. Anyway, they have talked about their techniques, which is sort of contextually similar to what Microsoft have done with Control Flow Guard in their compiler for a couple of years now, and they've released a full now public patch set against the Linux kernel that implements their technique, a whole bunch of benchmark results. So yes, if you're into exploiting kernel memory corruption bugs and you do want to have a look at the, you know, the current state of the art of mitigation techniques in the kernel, this is definitely a thing you should have a read through.
If that is what you're into, if that is your scene, as we say. Doozy of a bug in Steam, very much a, you know, Sammy Kamkar, you know, Sammy Worm style of thing. Looks like some people were exploiting it and having a good laugh about it on Twitter.
Yeah, so there's persistent cross-site scripting in the Steam profile. So if you viewed somebody else's profile, your browser would execute JavaScript in the context of your logged in Steam session. And I gather this worked through like the actual desktop Steam client, which of course is just a browser on the inside. It's not a, you know, it's just a browser based app. So yeah, this stuff actually would work in the real Steam client. And yeah, from there, you know, code execution in context of your session. So yes, could absolutely have wormed it, could have, you know, kind of prompted you to do a Steam update and drop malware on you, could have done all sorts of useful things. And yeah, Steam, Valve say that they have patched it, but this kind of bug, you know, has showed up a bunch of times in Steam, and that code base is not particularly fresh. You know, I think they need to do quite a lot of work to catch up with some of the technical debt they've accrued over the years on that platform.
Yeah, there could be a bit of a, yes, technical debt crisis, you'd think. Oh, now in good news for, and look, I can't claim this joke, this was Alex Stamos on Twitter, in good news for people who are preparing their 2018 submissions to Black Hat, WebKit has announced that they want tighter integration with GPUs and like an API that exposes modern GPU features, including low-level graphics and general-purpose computation. So yes, soon you will be able to run code on GPUs through a browser, which, you know, if it's done well, hey, great. But it's the sort of thing that, you know, you can imagine if they screw this up, it's going to be bad.
Yeah, it certainly does expose a bunch of low-level features. And the intent here, I guess, is to provide an API that is at a lower level than the current WebGL you know, browser standard, something closer to Vulkan or MSDX12 or whatever the Apple Metal, the Apple one's called Metal, not me, the other. The Apple one that's called Metal that isn't me. It's very confusing. Anyway, something that's kind of on that level of abstraction, whether or not we will now see, you know, websites having a business model where they'll, like, you know, mine Kanye coin on your box whilst you're browsing their site using a GPU instead of showing you advertising. I don't know. Maybe that is the future that WebKit is going to build for us.
The ball could bounce in any direction. That's the that's the fun of life, isn't it? Now, look, some news from home, and I really actually did want to do a feature interview about this week, but unfortunately, I contacted the Defense Department. They couldn't provide me with anyone who could do an audio interview, and they referred me to Alastair McGibbon, who is our Prime Minister's cybersecurity advisor. Unfortunately, Parliament is sitting this week, and it's been a bit chaotic, and you know, there was no way he was going to be able to speak about this, but ASD, you know, our equivalent of the NSA, they're very well known for releasing very sensible advice for organizations in terms of what they can do to mitigate most attacks. I mean, they've had their top four out for quite some time. I mean, they've won awards for this stuff, you know, and their top four is application whitelisting, patching applications, patching operating system vulnerabilities, and restricting administrative privileges. That's their top four. They've now broadened that to top eight, and I got to say, looks like more sensible advice.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing that really characterized the ASD top four and the overall kind of top 30 and the way that they ranked them and judged them in terms of their difficulty to implement that kind of thing, was that it was all extremely pragmatic and sensible and just good advice, which is rare in the InfoSec industry. And so, yeah, I think this update to them, which I think is the second or third update that they've made to this list over the years since they published it in 2010, this update, yeah, is very, very sensible. They've kind of broken it up a bit more than they have in the previous one. But yeah, essentially now there is this top eight or essential eight set of controls, which cover some of the things that were in the previous top four, but adds things like turn off office macro settings. Super straightforward, not going to get you owned. Why don't you do it? And then a bunch of other things like multi-factor auth for remote access and having backups, which, you know, hopefully wouldn't have to be a thing you'd tell people, but clearly it is in this age of ransomware. So no, it's yeah.
Backup a really important good data daily seems like good advice when everyone's getting crypto locked.
Well, exactly, yeah. So no, I think it's a really good write-up, and the way it's explained is good, and it's kind of, you know, it's a really good document to refer to and to use when explaining the kind of choices that you're making. You know, for example, running antivirus software with up-to-date signatures is currently rated limited, which is the lowest of their ratings of utility, and perhaps you should spend your effort elsewhere, which is good advice. So yes, I'm glad that they have left that.
Well, I mean, their absolute number one, and has been for years, is application whitelisting. They say if you do that, you are so far ahead. They put that ahead of patching, if you know what I mean.
Which, you know, actually isn't – I agree. That's – yeah, app whitelisting can be very, very powerful. It's not universally positive and good in every case, but – you know, even if you don't patch your stuff.
It's just unfortunate, isn't it, that their number one control is one of the most difficult, you know, because whitelisting is hard.
It is kind of difficult, yes.
And it's easy for them to say, hey, just whitelist everything and make sure your access control is perfect. And it's like, yeah, you know, done. But but still, it is a limited list. And you know, I think it's great that ASD releases this sort of advice. I'm surprised NSA don't do it in as clear a manner.
Yeah, and I think the American guidance is so much more kind of convoluted to parse and figure out. You dig through the NIST standards and all of that kind of, and it's just really difficult to get a.
Did you just say defiggled?
Defiggled. I hope it didn't say defiggled.
I think you just said it's very difficult.
It's hard, all right? Hard. That's a good word.
All right.
Hard is easy word. Easy word.
Well, Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to chat to you, and we'll check in with you next week.
Thank you, Pat. You will indeed, and I will look forward to it.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Tenable Network Security's chief executive, Amit Uran. This week's show is, of course, brought to you by Tenable Network Security. Amit is new to the position with Tenable, but he's hardly new to InfoSec. He was a director of US CERT for a time back in the day, before he teamed up with the founders of NetWitness, which for its time was really cool tech. NetWitness was eventually acquired by RSA, and Amit became RSA's chief executive before announcing his departure for Tenable in, I think it was December last year. And it feels like a good fit. Tenable is a company that was founded off the back of Nessus, but these days it sells a pretty broad suite of products. Nessus is still obviously, you know, a big product for Tenable, but they've really expanded the approaches they offer in terms of getting the job done. Tenable sells a log correlation engine, active and passive vulnerability scanners, and they've just launched their new platform, Tenable.io. It's been really interesting for me, and I've said this a few times, it's been really interesting for me to watch Tenable grow. They've been a sponsor of this podcast for something like 9 years, and I think when they first signed on, they had something like 40 staff, and now they have hundreds, and they're still, you know, rapidly expanding, like everyone else in InfoSec. So, you know, the startups of today become the incumbents of tomorrow. I've been around long enough to actually see that with my own eyes. And yeah, security software firms often start with a point solution. In Tenable's case, that was Nessus. But they have to broaden eventually to stop someone else coming in and eating their lunch. And honestly, it's really hard to imagine anyone eating Tenable's lunch these days. It is a very complicated lunch, let's put it that way. And I don't mean that in a bad way. These days, Tenable's platform ingests information from pretty much everything. Cloud platforms, passive scanners at the gateway, active scanners, whatever. As you'll hear, Tenable's new whiz-bang platform even ingests data from other vulnerability scanners like Qualys. I guess the point here is they're no longer that company who makes Nessus. They offer a platform now, And sure, it's not as simple as use their stuff and you won't get owned. I mean, there's no InfoSec company that sells something that you can just buy and you won't get owned. But look, I honestly don't know how any enterprise out there can actually get a good view of at least where they should be distributing their security resources without using a platform like this one. So yeah, Tenable doesn't have the same sort of sprawl as RSA, but they sure as hell aren't just a scanner company anymore, which is why I think Amit Yoran is a great fit. Now, if you're so inclined, and you'll hear me refer to this interview in this one, go back and have a listen to the sponsor interview in episode 425, if you missed it. Now, that was with a Tenable customer named Gary Hayslip. He's the chief security officer of the city of San Diego. And that one was interesting because he was using Tenable stuff as much to get an idea of what he was dealing with early in his job than anything else. You know, he rolled Tenable just to give him visibility across, you know, the computers in the cop cars and the ICS, as well as, you know, different divisions that he was, you know, suddenly responsible for. And he could see who was doing their job and where stuff was falling between the cracks and things like that. That's where these platforms are really great for that visibility. But as we heard last week in our interview with Nathaniel Wakelam, figuring out what a company's assets actually are is getting increasingly complex. And, you know, what about cloud assets? And, you know, furthermore, encryption doesn't help this situation from a passive scanning point of view. So, you know, I spoke to Amit about basically, you know, Tenable's approach to the contemporary challenge, if you will. And I'll drop you into my conversation with him from about the point where I'm speaking about passive scanners and encryption. You know, are they still useful now that everything on the wire is encrypted? As you'll hear, he basically says, yes, there's still value in that. But you do really need those multiple approaches to asset identification these days in order to achieve anything approaching comprehensive visibility. Here's Amit Yoran.
Yeah, so clearly encryption creates a level of obfuscation that reduces your visibility, reduces your clarity. What I would say is, you know, we provide the greatest amount of visibility possible into that infrastructure given how it's behaving. So the fact that there's a new device on the network is sometimes interesting. So being able to profile and do change, you know, identification to the enterprise, hey, here's a new system. Or a new system is speaking on a new port and protocol that it hasn't spoken on before, or it's offering a new service. So we don't see the encrypted, obviously the content of encrypted communications, but we can say, hey, somebody's now listening and receiving communications or sending communications in a port and protocol or on a system that hasn't been behaving this way in the past. This is probably something that might be of interest to the security program if it's, you know, not how it's expected to be behave or how it hasn't been behaving in the past. So it's an awesome
capability. You can also do stuff like, you know, if you can grab the MAC address and maybe do something with that, like look to see if it's within a range that belongs to a certain device manufacturer. Is that something you actually do?
Yeah, so we do that. It's interesting. With our Tenable IO platform, we actually have developed and are now licensing our entire technology platform on an asset basis. So we've got a series of constructs that go back and identify the asset itself as opposed to looking at the world as IP addresses. A great example of that is looking at the MAC addresses, profiling unique identifiers on the systems themselves. So we'll look up MAC addresses and we'll use that as one of the ways of profiling and deduplicating our asset understanding for the organization. MAC addresses are one effective way to do that.
Now, obviously, you know, the shift to the cloud is a big deal, and Tenable has been making moves in the direction so that it can, you know, take information from anything from Salesforce to Azure to AWS to Office 365. I'd imagine that you've introduced some new integrations into the new platform, into the Tenable.io thing. Is that correct?
Right. So we've got a series of new integrations. Some are with our own capabilities. You know, as you said, we made an acquisition of FlawCheck last year. We've integrated that to give you visibility into containers and make sure that security is part of that DevOps process, as opposed to, you know, an afterthought process, which slows down the operational environment and is really not acceptable to where organizations are going with containers and with DevOps. But it's also in being a platform vendor you know, as a service for their threat and vulnerability management. So look at, for instance, the ingest of third-party data sources. We can take in not only our own scan information, but we are able to pull in scan results from other vulnerability scan platforms and capabilities like Qualys. So, you know, regardless of how you
So you can ingest Qualys scan results? I bet they love that.
Well, listen, it's we're serving enterprise customers, and as much as we'd love to sell them, you know, three of everything Tenable, the fact is, you know, we've got to be an open platform and work with all of the technologies which they've acquired over the years and give them and help them generate the greatest possible value out of the money they're spending with us and the money they've already spent with other vendors over time.
Now, last week's show, we had an interview with Nathaniel Wakelam, who was talking a lot about using sort of passive recon tricks and, you know, public data to identify assets that, you know, otherwise just wouldn't be identified. Doing things like pulling metadata out of SSL certificates, looking at, you know, open sources of DNS data to find weird subdomains when some developer spins something up. I mean, my favorite trick that he spoke about last week was he scanned the entire internet for and downloaded every single fav icon on the planet and then MD5'd them to see which ones matched so he could match, you know, maybe undocumented servers against certain target companies by matching the fav icons, right? So is that something that Tenable's looking at as well, this OS open source intelligence approach?
It's probably something that we'll look at more closely over time as we deepen the threat component of our TVM capabilities. In the meantime, even doing simple things with you know, things like the passive vulnerability scanner that you identified and looking at the broader modern compute environment. You know, we talked a lot about containers. We talked a lot about some of the cloud capabilities or integrating third-party data. But even looking at what organizations are doing with IoT and all the IoT devices and control devices in their environments and be able to identify those, profile those, see where those are vulnerable and exposed, could be used to as vulnerability points against the enterprise is quite helpful to organizations as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, we just heard that the DC police had to run around fixing up their CCTV cameras when they all got hosed like in the days leading up to Donald Trump's inauguration, right? And that's a pretty high impact problem when you're the DC police.
It's a high impact problem when you're the DC police. It's a high impact problem when you're, you know, Brian Krebs or his DNS provider and being taken down by, you know, web cameras. And I think, you know, those are interesting examples where you're seeing, you know, the device, the physical world infrastructure, because it isn't being developed in a secure way, impacting the cyber infrastructure. And I think what we're going to increasingly see is the inverse of that. So cyber infrastructure going after the physical devices, kind of with the DC police example, and having an impact, right? Can you open locks to doors? Can you change thermostat settings? Can you change energy profile? Can you do all sorts of things which could really wreak havoc into the modern enterprise and into effectively their business process by cyber means? And I think that sort of situation and level of exposure are really unfolding in 2017. And I would be surprised if we don't see more examples of that and in more dramatic ways in the coming quarters and years.
So some time ago in one of these sponsored interviews, we had a chat with Gary Hayslip, who's the CISO for the city of San Diego. And that was a really interesting chat. And it made a lot of sense. I'm thinking from a Tenable perspective to get him to do that interview because, you know, for him, it just worked so well in terms of getting a grip on the environment. I mean, he had everything from like embedded boxes in police cars to worry about to, you know, ICS when it comes to water and sewer, which is a city responsibility. So I'm guessing, you know, the IoT stuff isn't necessarily that new to Tenable. You've been dealing with that stuff for a while, since before it was hip, I'm guessing.
We've been dealing with it since before it was hip, but I think it's becoming increasingly valuable to companies. So, you know, when I take a step back and I look at why Tenable is becoming a more relevant or more strategic provider, right? I think the cynical view would be, oh, you guys build a vulnerability scanner into legacy enterprise environments, and that's really, you know, that's a, it's a real legacy business. And so you could certainly take that perspective and say, wow, we've got to change. The great news is Tenable's a very dynamic company. Almost 50% of the employees have been in the organization for 3 years or less. So we're growing very rapidly and bringing in a lot of new talent. And so we've got a great base to build from, which is how do you assess vulnerabilities? How do you measure exposures? And using that core, that, you know, sort of 14 years of experience doing that in things like IoT, but then applying that discipline to the modern computing environments. And that's where I think, you know, Tenable has a really nice combination of domain expertise and fresh perspective that can help our customers really transform their businesses.
Well, it's funny, isn't it, that we're always talking about how, you know, the rush to the cloud and everything's changing and woo, woo, woo. But at the end of the day, right, like all of this IoT stuff and ICS, you know, that's 90s computing and it's not going anywhere.
Exactly. It's just an expansion of the attack surfaces. They embrace new technologies because a lot of these enterprises, you know, remain steadfast in their deployment and lifecycle management of the stuff they've already built and are not likely to migrate off of in the near future, but they're embracing the new stuff too. And that's where you've got to be able to provide a holistic understanding of exposure and risk to customers and help them manage it versus just remain focused on that legacy stuff. Or even just focus on the new stuff, because that isn't helpful either.
Now, I've got to ask you, because you were the, you know, founder of NetWitness, acquired by RSA. You were the CEO of RSA. You've had a nice view across the entire industry over the last sort of 8 years or so. And I'm really curious to know what tech outside of Tenable's portfolio you're getting interested in, because yeah, you've been around and you've done some interesting things. So I'm super curious.
I think that there's a lot of really exciting things happening in the world of technology which can impact the security space, right? We talked a lot about cloud. We talk a lot about containers. We talk about the sort of expansion of organizations' use of technology. I think some of those expansions, some of the new technologies, are actually quite relevant in security. If you look at things happening in the world of AI and, you know, machine learning, that has tremendous relevance in security space in terms of helping to understand behaviors, identify pain points, identify key exposures.
The way that I always describe the value proposition of something like machine learning is I say, look at Splunk, which gives you amazing visibility, but no one sort of knows how to drive it. You know, you take something that's good at collecting data like Splunk, and then you attach some machine learning to something like that, and all of a sudden you've got something very valuable. That seems to be a simple way to describe the benefit.
Exactly. It sort of brings it in a practical way, in a usable form, down to the customer population, right? Unless you're a very large enterprise with a massive investment, it's really, really hard to make heads or tails of this stuff on your own. But if you can drive that down in a consumable way into the broader user population, there's tremendous opportunity.
Is this something that Tenable's looking at? I mean, are you looking at bolting machine learning into, you know, some of your stuff? Because I'm trying to think of where it would make sense. I'm guessing you'd find a place for it.
So we do have some interesting, what I call, research going on in this area through the Nessus Cloud customer base, and now with Tenable.io, you know, we've got a couple of thousand customers running our vulnerability assessment capabilities as a service.
And you're receiving all of their logs in aggregate, right? So there's a data store that you can do some interesting stuff with.
Exactly. And it becomes pretty interesting for our customers too if we have some aggregate visibility and capability to offer them some increased level of insight.
Amit Uran, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business.
Patrick, it was great speaking with you.
That was Amit Yaran of Tenable Network Security there. Big thanks to them. I actually met Amit once before when he was at RSA. And yeah, he's a very smart guy, and I'm sure he'll do very well over there at Tenable. Big thanks to Tenable Network Security for its sponsorship of this week's Risky Business episode. Do go check out tenable.io also. I mean, even if you're not planning on buying anything in that space, it's... you know, I mean, just look at the scope of this thing and, you know, it'll probably give you an idea of realistic directions the industry is moving in when it comes to sort of, you know, tracking assets and vulnerabilities in those assets. And yeah, that's almost it for this week's show. But before we go, of course, it is time for Story Corner with Jake Davis. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
A lot of people have asked me recently if I did play Scrabble with John McAfee in his cabin. Without really answering that question, I'm just going to tell you about the time I played Guess Who with John McAfee in his beach hut. He has a cabin. He has a beach hut. He has like a small shed as well. The shed is post-bath salt. The cabin is pre-bath salt. And the beach hut is mid-bath salt. So that's where we were. I was just having wine. I was having his own wine, called McAfee, of course. And he went over to his game shelf, a lot of games, loves his board games. Took out Guess Who, you know Guess Who? All pictures of faces and that, and you get one and you have to say, you know, is my person wearing glasses? And they go, no, 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 no. And then you flip all the ones wearing glasses until you're left with a few, and then you can guess. Anyway, first strange thing about this, there were no human faces. They were all like symbols for software and all computer-based things. So there was, you know, there was the Firefox logo. There was like, you know, the battery logo in Ubuntu, that was there. And... they had the little volume as well, and there was a sort of Windows command prompt logo. All logos, software logos, Guess Who. I thought, that's weird, but I kind of like it. I like what he's done here. I wonder if he made this himself, someone made it for him. I don't want to know, I just want to play. So we did. So I had the Internet Explorer logo. Thought that would be pretty hard to guess, you know, the blue and the E. It's a letter, but it's very. So I had that. I felt good. I felt confident this time. John McAfee wanted to go first. Said okay. He said, "Is your logo wearing a hat?" I said, "No, no, I'm no. It's not. It doesn't have a hat." And suddenly he flipped down everything on his board. Everything. Apparently every. And I looked at my board. I realized everything has a hat. Everything has a hat except Internet Explorer. Like the Windows command prompt has a hat, has a little fedora. The Ubuntu power bar is wearing a top hat. And he flipped down everything. He flipped it all off, and he was left with one. And he said, "Can I guess? Are you Internet Explorer logo?" I said, "Yes, John, I am." And he just looked at me and went, "Ah. Good game. One of my favorites is Guess Who. I play it all the time. Even though I haven't had anything to do with McAfee antivirus for 15 years, I still enjoy a game of Guess Who from time to time in my beach hut. Now, if you'd like to join me in my shed, I have another game I would like to play with you." So again, I like John. Eccentric millionaire, eccentric guy, has bespoke Guess Who. I dig it. And one piece of advice though, just never ask him how to uninstall McAfee antivirus. That really sets him off.